there were also some conflicts back then about, you know, what kind of version of feminism we want to support, some sort of maternalism or paternalism from the Western guests towards the Yugoslav women. They all thought that, you know, the Yugoslav women were not feminist enough yet, or their feminism needed to develop much more. And the Yugoslav were very proud, on the other hand, that say, you're not here to give us lessons, we're trying to learn from you. So I think that our history can really give us a sense also of how people felt.
Gender und mehr, leicht gesagt. Willkommen zur 18. Folge von Gender und mehr, leicht gesagt. In dieser Folge geht es wieder einmal um Südosteuropa. Ich habe natürlich meine Gäste Chiara Bonfiglioli und Rory Archer gefragt, wieso dieses Thema für die Genderforschung und auch generell interessant ist. Außerdem geht es in dieser Folge um Intersektionalität und methodische Zugänge. Dieses Interview ist wieder auf Englisch. Ich wünsche allen, die zuhören, viel Vergnügen. Gender und mehr. Thank you for tuning in. This episode I talk to Chiara Bonfiglioli and Rory Archer, who are working together on a research project on women's and gender history in Southeast Europe in the 20th century. In this episode, we will hear something about their individual research projects, research approaches, and intersectionality. But now, something about those two people. Chiara Bonfiglioli is an assistant professor of contemporary history in the Department of Humanities at Gia Foscari University of Venice, Italy. She is the principal investigator of the ERC consolidator project titled Wu Nam, Woman and Non-Alignment in the Cold War Era, Biographical and Intersectional Perspectives. From 2017 to 2023, she lectured in Gender and Women's Studies at University College Cork, where she coordinated the one-year interdisciplinary Masters in Women's Studies. Rory Archer is a social historian of the Balkans in the 20th century. He is originally from Ireland but works at the University of Graz, more specifically the Center for Southeast European Studies. Right now, he works on two different projects. One is about Albanian migration in socialist Yugoslavia, and the second is about the Yugoslav workforce in Zambia. He's also teaching in the master's program Southeast European Studies. Enough said, now enjoy the interview. You two carried out a research project together as part of the Elisabeth List Fellowship Program, and it also deals with gender. So I would like to ask you where your interest in gender studies or generally gender comes from, and what do you find interesting about it?
Okay, well, I suppose I became interested in gender for both for I suppose personal, private reasons and professional research as well. I mean, I'm from Ireland, and in the last decade, there's been very high-level campaigns and successful campaigns for marriage equality and for abortion rights, for kind of broader reproductive justice. So this is something which in a kind of an activist and personal sense, I've been interested in. Also, these issues are in Southeastern Europe are also of relevance. And then I think in terms of my own research, I didn't start off as a historian, as a gender historian. But maybe more as a general social historian. But I found that gender is an important lens that emerges in research on social historical research of the Balkans. For example, when I was doing my PhD, which is focused on the workplace and housing in late socialist Yugoslavia, I found that gender would emerge as an emic concept, as a kind of concept that people that I was doing research with, like oral history narrators, would speak about it, and that it's, you know, meaningful in the sense that factory workers would speak about their workplace being a male factory or a female factory based on the workforce, the type of, you know, the composition of the workforce, the type of work being done there. And so I found that in some ways that gender can be everywhere in a sense. And so then I followed it up a little bit more closely then in more recent years.
So for me, it started in from different direction. I think one was being an Erasmus student in Paris at the time in which the famous or infamous law on the banning of Muslim headscarf was approved in 2004, and I was already interested back then in all these intersections of gender, ethnicity, race, post-colonialism, and that's why I decided to write my BA dissertation on the topic. And at the same time, I started to be interested in gender relations in the Balkans. I volunteered with a student organization in Kosovo just after the wars at the beginning of the 2000s. And there I really could feel this kind of gap between our own position as Western women volunteering and the local women, which were subjected to a certain amount of patriarchal gender relations there, and also like this differentials in terms of, you know, being the Westerners in a post-war country. And so from that moment on, I found this interest in gender relation in Southeast Europe, and I started reading feminist texts from authors such as Rade Bekovic, Slavenka Drakulic, other women that were writing about gender and nationalism in the Balkans, and that's how I decided to go for a research master in gender studies, or gender and ethnicity, as it was called at the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands, which is a quite long-standing and prestigious program in the sense that it's one of the most established when it comes to gender research. And there I continued with my PhD. So my PhD was about post-war activism in Italy and Yugoslavia, and I compared the communist women's organizations after World War II. Well, the Italian one was combining both communist and socialist women, the Yugoslav one was communist, but I was looking at the ways in which gender became an issue basically in the post-war period and during the Cold War, and how women were contributing to the creation of Cold War discourses. So for me, I think gender has always been a way to look at the ways in which power relations are constructed, but also the ways in which different intersections of power are related to each other.
As I mentioned earlier, you two work together on a research project. Can you tell me more about it? What is it about?
Okay, yeah, the research project is titled Women's and Gender History in Southeastern Europe in the 20th Century, Oral History, Ethnographic and Biographical Approaches as a Way to Advance Intersectionality. So this is a long title and a bit of a mouthful, but what we're trying to do through the project is an attempt to better connect existing research on gender in Southeastern Europe with other strands of foci, such as class, ethnicity, racialization. There's been quite a lot of really great research on gender and women's history in Southeastern Europe in the last maybe 20 years or so. But sometimes it's treated a little bit in isolation. So it's looking at sort of gender as a category on its own without maybe relating to other topics. And so this project is an attempt to see how gender intersects with other categories of identity. And in doing the project, I should mention as well that we're actually four researchers involved in the project. So in addition to myself and Chiara, we're joined by Rachel Trode, who is completing her PhD in the European University Institute of Florence. She's working on a topic of striking women workers in late Habsburg ruled Bosnia. So that's the start of the 20th century. And we're also joined by Geralda Delia, who is a PhD researcher in the University of Regensburg in Germany. And her research is focused on the participation of women and girls in the Kosovo Liberation Army. So that's the late 1990s and the lead up to and during the war in Kosovo. Whereas then Chiara and myself are more focused on the mid 20th century. So we're looking primarily at socialist Yugoslavia from different perspectives, such as gender, labor, and other issues too.
I think that our aim was to kind of, you know, the term, we're going to come to the issue of intersectionality, but usually intersectionality is very much a term used in gender studies and social sciences. And for us, it was a way to apply it to our research area, which is gender history and women's history in Southeast Europe. So I think that it was one of the aim of the project.
You just mentioned intersectionality. Can you please explain what you mean by that, especially in the relation to your research project?
Yeah, so just to give a short background, intersectionality is a term that was coined first by Kimberly Crenshaw in the late 80s. Kimberly Crenshaw is a Black American lawyer, and she was looking at the way in which basically the law wasn't taking into account intersecting discriminations, right? So she made this example of Black women that were not hired in General Motors, and they sued the company, and the company said, but we are hiring Black men and we are hiring white women. White women were mainly secretaries in the company, and Black men were mainly blue-collar workers, but the Black women were not being hired. And so they were kind of standing at this intersection of gender and race, and they were not being seen. And what Kimberly Crenshaw says is that if we don't have the tools to see this intersection, then a number of people are going to fall into the tracks of this double discrimination. And this idea of double or triple discrimination or jeopardy is something that was not only formulated by Crenshaw, but it was formulated by other African-American feminist, Black feminist, let's say from the 1960s onwards. So this term is quite connotated in terms of the history of feminism as coming from, you know, a specific context, which is the United States, but somehow it has traveled. It's a traveling term, and it has become quite consensual in gender and women's studies as a way to say, okay, we are acknowledging that women have different experiences and different lives, and that, you know, there are other factors that are impacting women's lives, such as race, age, disability, nationality, citizenship, and others. And so intersectionality is somehow a way to look at gender discrimination while keeping into account all these other factors that might affect someone's position, but also institutional structure, power structure, for instance. And so to apply to Southeast Europe, well, I think especially when we look at the ways in which women's lives have been represented in the region, starting from the socialist period, but also going to the post-war period after the Yugoslav wars, there was very much a certain degree of essentialization, right? So a certain degree of gender essentialism, ethnic essentialism. We didn't really get the span of complexity of women's lives in the region from international media, local media, and so on. So to use intersectionality is a way to say, look, there is a lot of complexity here. Women have very different lives. This was the case as well in the interwar period, but also during socialism and in the post-socialist aftermath, depending on class, ethnicity, nationality, citizenship, the location even of people, where people were born. Like if we look at the ways in which the Yugoslav wars developed, there is not one single place where the dynamic of the conflict was the same, right? So intersectionality is a way for us to take into account all this micro level and factors and look at the ways in which gender, not only women, of course, I'm talking about gender, but it's not, that doesn't stand only for women, as we know, also about men, right? So femininities and masculinities, they are taking different shape and different declinations depending on their spatiotemporal location.
Yeah, I suppose in historical research, for example, through oral history interviews or some of these qualitative methods, we kind of see intersectionality in action in some way. So if maybe we speak with a university educated and married cis woman in a major city like Belgrade or Zagreb, she might reflect very differently on the recent past than to say an ethnic minority factory worker in a smaller town or somebody working in agriculture. So even though, yeah, of course, as Chiara mentioned, this intersectionality sort of, you know, a theoretical sense comes out of the North American context, but I think there is value as well in applying it in a Yugoslav context as well. And I think this is also, at the same time, there's a growing interest in issues of race and racialization. I think for us, it makes sense to sort of interrogate some of the ways that systems of inequality based on gender and race, class and ethnicity, ability, location, how these intersect to create unique effects and also material outcomes for individual people. And it does also influence how they think about the past, how they consider their own role within it. The kind of narratives they have arrived today.
Can you give an example how intersectionality matters in your research?
I can give an example from the research project that I'm working on, which is called To the Northwest, Intra-Yugoslav Albanian Migration, 1953 to 1989. And I'm looking at Albanian private sector workers. So these are people who are not engaged in the social sector, the state sector, but are sort of private workers in socialism. And I can see that for these people who moved to Croatia working in private business sector, they were affected not only because they were an ethnic minority, that they were Albanians from Kosovo, so Albanian speakers, sometimes Muslims, sometimes Catholics, but also because they were an economic minority as well, that they were working in the private sector. So they were excluded from a lot of, let's say, socialist citizenship, the kind of the political rights and even social welfare, which was accessible through the state or social sector workplace. And so, in this way, you can see the kind of the particular material outcomes for these people, because in some ways you could say that they were privileged to be in the private sector, to have sort of more control of their own earnings. And then in other ways, they were deprivileged or at risk in some way because they weren't able to sort of participate in mainstream Yugoslav society in the same way as maybe factory workers.
I have an example that just came to my mind from my project on the history of the textile industry and its aftermath in the post-Yugoslav region. And it's a story that was told to me by a manager of one of these factories. So he was in charge of improving, let's say, the business of the factory after its privatization, right? So he was trying to improve the sales and everything. And then he said that there was a woman that just came from Bosnia. So she was likely displaced from Bosnia to Zagreb. And she was one of the women that was selling products in one of the shops for the factory. And I say, she really hated me at that point because I told her, look, with this accent, you're not going to be able to sell anything to Zagreb ladies, right? So there was this mix of urban, rural difference, ethnic difference, maybe not because she might have been as well from the same ethnic, let's say, group, but there was this, definitely this kind of urban way of looking down to people from the countryside or from Bosnia was always being considered kind of backward from the perspective, for instance, of Croatia. And so I said, look, she really hated me when I said that. But then after a few years, we met again and she thanked me because thanks to me, she really changed her outlook. She changed her accent and she became a real Zagreb lady. And she was really successful with her sales and she became, you know, like this very successful shopkeeper. So I think that was really, you know, here you could really see this hierarchy of gender, you know, the man telling the woman how she should behave, but also this hierarchy of urban versus rural, Croatia versus Bosnia, and the class dimension as well, like the accent that is, you know, signifying the class of somebody or the origin of somebody and how to get rid of that to be able to integrate into the new post-socialist Croatia, right? So that was just a small example from a talk I had with somebody during my research.
As we already heard right now, you both have your very different individual research project. Can you tell me more about that?
My previous book came out in 2019, the one about the textile industry. So it's also book recommendation. Yes, for book recommendation. So it's called Women and Industry in the Balkans, The Rise and Fall of the Yugoslav Textile Sector. And I sort of closed that project now because after 7 years working on the textile industry, I was ready to go back to my original interest, which is on women's transnational history during the Cold War. So I recently got this ERC Consolidator grant for the next 5 years, which is quite a big grant. So it's I'm going to hire 5 postdoctoral researchers that are going to work with me, and we're going to look at the history of women and the non-aligned movement. Yugoslavia was part of the non-aligned movement, but we're going to include also countries from the global south. So Egypt, Tunisia, Cuba, and India, and we're going to try to compare the ways in which women's activists have been active in their own countries, but also connecting with United Nations bodies and other international organizations, for instance, the International Planned Parenthood Federation, which was in charge of discussions about family planning and population policy. So that's a way for me not to move away from the Balkans, but to look at the history of Yugoslavia also through this transnational lens. And in particular, I would like to write a biography of Vida Tomšić, who was a Slovene politician, partisan, and after the war, she was the kind of the main theoretician for gender and welfare issues. And so she traveled extensively. Also, she was a UN representative at a certain point. She traveled to different countries, especially India, but other countries as well. And she was also participating in the United Nations Decade for Women. So the Mexico City Conference in 75, the Copenhagen Conference in 1980, and the conference in Nairobi in 1985. And she passed away in 1998. So she also saw the dissolution of Yugoslavia. So it's quite a long span of time, right? From the interwar period when she radicalized as a communist up until the 80s, where she was kind of big authority in relation to non-alignment and development and family planning and so on. So I'm going to try to cover her life from a Yugoslav perspective, Slovene perspective, but also transnational perspective. That's part of this project, this ERC project I'm going to carry out. When it comes to the textile workers, yeah, that was it's mainly everything is in the book. But what is the main outcome is this feeling of, you know, we talk a lot about nostalgia for the socialist times in the region, because the transition was particularly brutal especially for factory workers and people working class people and people in rural areas, not to mention the wars, right? So even the places that didn't have direct conflict, they were quite heavily affected by privatization and economic de-development, as it has been called, right? So this feeling that, you know, there was a certain degree of development and then it disappeared with the factory closing and various businesses privatizing. So for me, I think one of the interesting outcomes of the book is to find that different women, working class women working in factories in the most different places, right? So from Slovenia to Macedonia to Bosnia to Serbia, they had a very similar point of view, right? And so that their gender, generation, class really shaped their discourse. And many of them were arguing that they were living better during socialist time than in the post-socialist period. Okay, so this was not just a nostalgia, like abstract nostalgia, but it was really nostalgia for labor rights, right? So they were not so much nostalgic about the system or the politics of socialism. They were really feeling like, okay, as workers, we were treated better before and we had more rights and we had more dignity and we were not considered just disposable subjects, which is what's happening now in many factories, especially this very exploitative textile factories that are still existing in some places like Macedonia and Serbia. So some of them could directly compare the ways in which the work was happening, right? So they could say, you know, before I had X number of rights and afterwards I was just exploited much more. And so they had this direct comparison. And so for me, it's a way to argue, you know, nostalgia is not just something, you know, that people are, let's say, making up. It's really like rooted in their lived experience and in their, especially their working experience.
Maybe I can follow this to continue. My main work at the moment is writing a book, which is I'm at the start of, and it's called Socialist Entrepreneurs: Intra-Yugoslav Albanian Labor Migration in Croatia. And unlike the category of people that Chiara worked with in her book, which was those who were employed in industry, I'm looking at those who are employed in the private sector. So it means that they necessarily don't have the same kind of nostalgia for the socialist system and these kind of labor rights because they were private sector workers. And sort of the research paradigm of intersectionality is extremely important here because in the book I hypothesize that the experience of migration for Albanians in Croatia during socialism was shaped by a range of factors, including religion, whether one was Islamic, Muslim or Catholic or secular, gender and family, whether one was male or female, and of course where they were in a kind of a family hierarchy, the place of origin, whether one is from a rural or urban area, their political orientation, whether they were sort of loyal Yugoslav communists or more Albanian national sympathizers. And I argue that these categories have really intersected and they result in different material outcomes for the individuals concerned. So I'm trying to unpack these in the book.
What I find very interesting is also that you look at different approaches to researching history. You mention, or in your title it says, oral history, ethnographical, biographical approaches. Can you tell us more why this was interesting for you and what approaches you used in your individual research projects?
We focus on sort of a range of qualitative methods, like including oral history, ethnography, biographical approaches. And I suppose the logic of using these methods is to gain new empirical data on the one hand. But it's not only about mining, sort of, mining for new sources of data, but also these methods are sort of well poised to include the voices of those who might be sort of historically excluded or marginalized. And there's also a focus not only on the new empirical data, but the meaning this has and for the people concerned in the context. So for example, in my project looking at Albanian migration, I rely on a triangulation between oral history, archival documents, and print media, with often print media which has ego perspectives, where people are speaking in the I voice and speaking about their own lives. And the logic of that is that there's a kind of a triangulation between the different sources, that there's sort of for each particular method, there is, I suppose there's benefits and then somehow weaknesses or limits. And then sometimes triangulating the different methods then tries to compensate for that in a way. So for example, some of the inaccuracies or maybe potential gaps of memory in oral history can be accounted for by relying on the kind of the so-called hard facts of the archive, or more sort of robust materials than from print media.
In my case, I did mainly for my book on the textile industry, I mainly did oral history interviews, even though I also triangulated to some extent with some printed material, especially like newspapers from the factories during socialist times, but also recent press material about the privatization of businesses in the post-Yugoslav space. And also I used some other sources such as movies, for instance, like documentary movies, but also like fiction. It was a fictionalized series that was set in a textile factory in Bosnia-Herzegovina, for instance, in the Sana textile factory. And that was really kind of speaking of the way in which textile workers were represented in the 80s, for instance, and how people remember that series was giving us a sense of the nostalgia that people were feeling from the time when factories were still working and the war hasn't happened yet and so on. So I think cultural products such as fiction or movies or documentaries are also very important source to use for qualitative research. In my current project on the history of women and the non-aligned movement, I'm mainly going to use archival research and archival materials in different languages, but I'm also planning to conduct some oral history interviews with some of the people who are still alive and who are some insight into the Cold War period. I mean, this is something that's not easy. Sometimes when you're looking at this post-war Cold War period, there's not many women who are still with us. But I think it's also something that can complement the archive material. And for those women that I'm not able to reach anymore, I'm talking to their children, I'm talking to their former collaborators to get a better sense of their personality and their motivation. I think the archives are also sometimes a bit dry, or you cannot, especially because of a number of, for instance, in this elite women in politics that I'm looking at now, they were very much, they weren't really focusing on the personal aspect of their life, right? So there's also an issue of generation there. This generation from the post-war period, they were not so much, they were really looking at the collective, the party, the state. They were not that much focusing on their own personal lives, except in some cases. And so I think to combine archive material with oral history is always very productive.
And maybe one more, one source that we didn't mention is women's magazines, which I find can be really useful in the, both in the socialist era and post-socialist era. Sometimes in the socialist era, they have kind of a double function for the historian, which is on the one hand as being a source of empirical data of, you know, biographical accounts of particular women, or there'd be cases where they would take kind of a mini survey on issues of concern, but it's also setting an agenda. It tells us about how the social estate saw itself, the workplace, and what was the correct way to be a socialist citizen, to be a woman or to be a man. So it has kind of like a double function. And I found more recently for this Albanian migration project in Croatia, looking at bilingual women's magazines published by, more recently, like in the last 10, 15 years, published by a women's organization in Croatia. And yeah, this gives a lot of sort of biographical details, accounts of things like moving to Croatia, being a female Albanian migrant. And it kind of helps to maybe to feel a gap when there's in the absence of other sources. And sometimes it's been difficult to find with Albanian women who are willing to speak with me about their experience of migration. And so, sometimes these women's magazines as well are an important source.
So when I think about historians, I have in my mind people who go to the archive and look in old books or something. I find it very interesting that you interview people, and I wanted to ask you, how does that work? Do you only talk with them about the past, or do you also talk about the present or the future? How does it work in your research projects?
Well, yeah, it's definitely a dialogue between the present and the past, because of course, when we speak with somebody now in 2023 or the years, and the past is being reflected through the present and the things that happened in the meantime, and we have to be very conscious of that. But rather than seeing this as a weakness or a sort of a deficiency in the oral history approach, I would see this as a strength, because all of our historical research, whether we like it or not, I think if we're honest, it is influenced by the present. So even if someone is doing a political history based on the 1950s and 60s, of course, and they're working with documents only produced in that era, there still is a negotiation going on with the researcher about filtering the past through the present. So this just becomes, I think, more crystallized in oral history. But, we have to be aware of it too, that people's narratives change, their memory changes, it's unreliable. When people tell a story multiple times, the story grows arms and legs and changes, and we have to account for that. Not to understand an oral history account as being an objective truth, but rather a very subjective memory of the past. And this is also how it's sometimes oral history would then, I suppose, intersect with memory studies as well, about how people remember, how people recall the past too. So these are very big debates that need some attention in our work as well.
For my MA dissertation, I wrote about this conference that took place in the late 1970s in Belgrade, and this was the first international feminist conference that happened in Yugoslavia that was not sponsored by official women's organization. It was more like a dissident conference, and there were many Western guests from France, Italy, the UK, other West Germany. These were kind of the most important feminists of that time. And they all went to Belgrade and they all talked to the Yugoslav organizers. And what was really fascinating was to see the different memories about it when you talk to people 30 years later, and how there were also some conflicts back then about, you know, what kind of version of feminism we want to support, some sort of maternalism or paternalism from the Western guests towards the Yugoslav women. They all thought that, you know, the Yugoslav women were not feminist enough yet, or their feminism needed to develop much more. And the Yugoslav were very proud, on the other hand, that say, you're not here to give us lessons, we're trying to learn from you. So I think that our history can really give us a sense also of how people felt. That's something that sometimes you cannot gather from the archive material, but also how temporalities of feminism and gender relation change in relation to geopolitics, right? So a lot of these women in during Yugoslav times, they felt really equal to their Western counterparts. They felt that they were at the same level. They had Yugoslavia was kind of respected state, and they had a lot of relations with the global South, but also with Western Europe. And they didn't feel intimidated. I mean, they sent letters to Simone de Beauvoir to invite them and to say, come to Belgrade, we want to talk to you. Like, they really felt at the same level. And that's something that really changed during the war, when most of these organizations, most of the feminist organizations became NGOs that are funded by Western donors. And so this idea that, you know, that the Western women could learn from the Yugoslav women, that's something that kind of disappeared over time. And it was more like, no, we need to learn from the West and catch up with the West. And so that the kind of inferiorization of the local scene was something that was felt very much. So when this research came out, it was very much important for the local feminists, because they could see that they had their own genealogy of feminists thinking and feminist activism, and it's still something that's considered foundational for the region, for the whole region, because there were women from Belgrade, but also from Zagreb and Sarajevo who were organizing. And so, like, there is this transgenerational memory that's been built around, you know, the history of feminism, that I think is also important for us.
I just wonder, how do you as historians get in touch with people? How do you find them, and how do you approach them for your research projects?
It really depends. It's it depends, I suppose, on the project and the type of and the particular demographic that one wishes to speak with and to do interviews with. And previously, a lot of it starts with sort of a snowball method. So at the beginning, it would maybe be contacting friends, acquaintances, friends of friends, and asking for an entry point, and then speaking with the person, and then hoping that they can introduce you to other people who would like to speak with you. And sometimes it can be difficult. I mean, usually in oral history methodology, of course, there isn't an attempt to arrive at a number which is statistically significant, but one that is historically significant or representative. So it's about trying to access oral history accounts which are representative of the broader experience. And sometimes it works very well. Sometimes it's quite easy. I think it depends how specific the topic is. So there's some issues can be quite universal. So issues like work or housing, these kind of everyday life things. When I was doing my PhD, for example, was focused on the workplace and housing. And these were really issues that I think everybody could engage with to some degree. So in that case, it wasn't so difficult to get a selection of different working class narrators, where the criteria was just that they had been working during socialism. So this is really kind of the widest sense. But then more recently, I was looking for Albanian private sector workers in Croatia. So this is a much smaller group. This is also a group which had sometimes difficult relations with the socialist state and even the post-socialist state as a minority. So there was sometimes a bit of suspicion or resistance that someone wants to a stranger approaches your workplace and wants to speak with you about your private business, this is obviously much more sensitive than maybe thinking about a workplace in general terms. So in this case, it was, it demanded a more, yeah, more attention to sort of cultivating a collaborative relationship with the narrator or the potential narrator. In many cases, people simply said, no, I really, you know, I'm not willing to speak with you, which is completely fair. I mean, a stranger, but then in other cases, I would, you know, I met people, spoke with them. There was, you know, some level of trust, and then they would introduce me to their friends or neighbors or acquaintances. And then, yeah, in that way, the snowball method, works.
Yeah, in my case, I think it was also an issue of different femininities or women position in different locations. When I was interviewing women who had been active in Communist Party politics, women's organization, many of them are still active, right? So some of them, there is a woman in Italy, her name is Marisa Rodano. She is 100 years old and she's still active in politics, right? So you can find her relatively easy and talk to her. And these are the women that are kind of the public figures. So it's not difficult to contact them or to get to an interview with some of these women. And they're very visible. And I think they also give you a certain different account than somebody who has not been a public figure, right? So in the case of when I was trying to interview textile workers about the closure of their factories, I did what Rory mentioned. So I relied on friends, acquaintances, people who came from smaller towns that could introduce me to their mother, grandmother, aunt, because everybody had an aunt or somebody in the family working in a textile factory. That's how important it was during socialism. So I could then go to the place where this factory was located and then interview some of these women, and then they would refer me to some other friends. But definitely they will have a different kind of stance or a different authority, right? They would be like, oh, well, why do you want to know about this? You know, this is something that's not, they were not public figures, right? So you needed to kind of establish this trust and show that you cared about their working life and personal life, which is something that not many people cared about. There was also an issue of trauma and pain, because some of these women were really sad that their factories were privatized and went bankrupt in many cases. And so some said, it's too painful, I don't want to talk about it. And so that's also something that can happen depending on the topics, that, you know, you might want to access a broader amount of people, but that's not possible because some people are just not interested in talking, or it's too painful for them. So that's also something we should respect.
Yeah, you never know what goes on in people's lives, both, you know, regarding the topic of the research. For example, it might be, you know, painful because, you know, the topic in Chiara's case about deindustrialization, the closure of factories. But of course, there's also other things that go on in people's lives that we mightn't be made aware of. So we have to, you know, keep that in mind as well, and always kind of approach it with patience, with empathy, and also to be very respectful that someone isn't willing to speak. Or would prefer not to. But in general, I think people like to, not wanting to sound maybe a bit mean, but people like to speak about themselves. I think it's the, you know, the nature of people. They, people like to speak about things that matter to them. When this is affirmed by somebody else as well, I think it's, generally a sort of a positive experience for most people, to think about their lives. And I notice as well that there are some, let's say, some sort of gender differences in interviewing, whether it's the difference between interviewing women and men sometimes can be, I noticed this when I was doing research at PhD level about factory workers. And I think I very much in, there's an even distribution of female and male narrators. Which is representative, of course, of the workforce of the time, because in socialist Yugoslavia, most women were in paid work by the 1970s, 1980s. And there sometimes is a tendency, I think, to, as Chiara mentioned a little bit earlier, about people who've had a public role to be kind of, to already have a narrative and be able to speak about that. And that's something sometimes with, sometimes men are more willing to speak about the public realm and women to maybe speak more about the private realm. But I think that changes as well once you get to kind of speaking about your where someone is born, how they grew up, and speaking about their life. And then you can kind of really go into, I mean, what for us is most interesting is how people in their everyday lives, in their own, in their own ways, experience big kind of macro level events.
In this podcast, I already talked to researchers who focused on Southeast Europe as well in their project. So I think it's very interesting that you also have this focus, and you mentioned at some point that the research in this area grows. So I wanted to ask you, why do you find it particularly interesting to look at Southeast Europe?
I think there are a lot of reasons why Southeastern Europe is interesting in terms of history generally and gender history specifically. I mean, we're speaking from Graz, so of course we have geographical proximity. Within half an hour, we can be on the border with Slovenia, the former border between Austria and Yugoslavia. Of course, there's also, you know, historical legacies between, you know, Austria and the frame of the Habsburg Empire. But Southeast Europe is obviously a very small geographical space, but in the 20th century, in this small geographical space, we've had a really wide variety of different gender regimes and different social processes. Some were extremely emancipatory, some were not. We can think of things like in Ceausescu's Romania and this pronatalism in the 1970s and 1980s as maybe, you know, as a particularly, you know, sort of difficult or controversial aspect of gender history in the region. On the other hand, we can think of the inclusion of women in the labor force after World War II as kind of an emancipatory moment, along with really wide-ranging political and social rights in the post-World War II era. And then with the wars, the Yugoslav wars of the 1990s, then the sort of the region became in a way sort of almost catapulted into feminism in a more global sense. There was a lot of, you know, debates about war rape, about war victims, which sort of in some ways made it outsized because the feminists around the world were speaking about this. But at the same time, as Chiara has noted, there was a kind of a marginalization of Yugoslav feminists after the collapse of the state as well. And they were sort of, you know, no longer participating with colleagues on an equal or near equal footing. And a lot of, and while there has been a kind of a resurgence or a growth in studies looking at different aspects of gender history, at the same time, gender is often reduced to a kind of a box-ticking exercise for Western donors or for like processes of sort of, you know, Europeanization or where it's, yeah, and sometimes the kind of the some of the sort of political and particularly social rights have been really have been degraded in the post-socialist era. At the very same time, the sort of, you know, gender as a category has been pushed as well from outside the region. So there's a huge amount of debates, I think, that can be had about sort of, you know, how gender as a category has shifted over the long 20th century.
Yeah, and for me, I think is also this turmoil that the region underwent in the 20th century. What Rory mentioned about the gender regimes, that these were corresponding to these different citizenship regimes, right? So somebody could be born in Austria-Hungary, live through two Yugoslavias, and end up as an elderly person in the independent Croatia without ever moving from their house, right? So that's the amount of, and not to mention the occupation during World War II and so on. So this extreme amount of turmoil really affected gender relations and generations. And I think for me, what is still very interesting is that there is so little historical research that has been done in these years that go between the, you know, the World War II. There's quite a bit of research done on female partisans during World War II, women in the resistance, women in even collaborationist movements, but there is not much in this period that goes then from the early 50s up until the late 70s and 80s when second wave feminism started in the region as well. So that moment of construction of the Yugoslav state and how women were involved in it. That has been quite neglected for a long time, especially because we tended to have a more totalitarian perspective on socialism, like, okay, women were just oppressed under socialism, as in every other East European state within the socialist bloc, except that Yugoslavia was not in the socialist bloc, and its variety of socialism was quite different. And so there were a number of women who were protagonists of politics and welfare policies, and so that's what I'm focusing at the moment, kind of uncovering the different positions that women were in, from, you know, the politician to the ordinary factory work.
Looking at the Elisabeth List Fellowship project, what do you think are the most important outcomes of this project, or what is important to know about this project from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, this was more of a networking project, right? So it really was meant to sort of gather other students and other scholars who are working on these topics. Rory can talk a bit about the main outcomes in terms of the course for the University of Graz and of the workshop that we did. And like, we were sort of supervising as well the PhD students who were completing their own classes, and we're also planning to write a kind of final article summarizing what we found out.
So one of the main outcomes of this Elisabeth List Fellowship is the development of a seminar, a master seminar at the University of Graz, which is now in its second year. It's called Women's and Gender History in the 20th Century Southeastern Europe, and it's co-taught by Chiara and myself, and it takes place in English, and we're hoping that this will be an ongoing course, which is offered at the Center for Southeastern European Studies, that sort of strengthen the gender offer of the of our center. And yeah, and the course focuses on what we are researching and looking at, sort of key concepts and methods, different historical phases, and how this relates to gender history. In addition to this, we held a doctoral workshop last May at the University of Graz on the same topic, on women's and gender history in Southeastern Europe. And we had about, I think, over 20 researchers who were based in Austria, Austrian universities, German universities in former Yugoslav states, from Slovenia to Kosovo. And through this, creating a network of younger scholars who were conducting doctoral research on this topic. And we hope to continue with these kind of events. In terms then of our own our own research projects, we're working on different topics, but myself and Chiara hope to, by the end of our project, to be able to jointly write an article, sort of, you know, reviewing the state of the art, and with intersectionality as the core, and to sort of suggest some ways forward to further develop the literature and the state of the art. One of the things that I am trying to develop through this project in collaboration as well with Chiara is looking at masculinities and how men have been affected in different ways by the sort of the existing gender regimes. And in the case of the research I'm doing with the Albanian migrants in Croatia, one thing that's emerging very often is how adult men who are working in private businesses, so things like bakeries or jewelers, family-run businesses, how they were affected by either their father, or if in the case of their father had passed away, their uncle, or the sort of the head of the family. And now when they speak about their own wishes for their children, they often really articulate a kind of the importance of education for their sons and for daughters, and wish that they have more opportunities to branch out, to have more agency in their own everyday lives. So this is something that I'll be unpacking as well, how men have been affected by patriarchal structures and negatively impacted by it, and then as a consequence of that, wish to sort of change how future generations live.
Yeah, I think really what we should try to do, but we don't have time yet to really put ourselves to it, is to to try to theorize what it will look like to think of intersectionality in the region, right? So what kind of factors would be relevant to formulate the different intersections, because obviously it's very specific, and I think this urban-rural difference, that's something that anthropologists have emphasized very much. Also during Yugoslavia, there was a very strong uneven development of the different republics and different regions. So that's something that carries a legacy already from Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire. So there are all of these factors that are kind of shaping the way in which intersectionality looks like in the region. I think we should try to spell out that.
Yeah, to sort of theorize intersectionality, which in a way has become something of a buzzword. It's, you know, it's very mainstreamed in popular discourse. I think in social media in a non-academic setting, we should really look at how we can theorize this and how it can be adapted to the particular context of Southeastern Europe. Like as Chiara mentioned, there's certain structures such as developmental patterns, or the difference between cities and towns, cities and villages, urban and rural areas. And so there's certain local factors that means it would have to be sort of adapted to suit that local context as well.
I want to zoom out now and look at the big picture, so to say. What do you think? What significance does your research have for society at large? Why is this research important?
So in terms of relevance for society, I think the research is important because it can account for perspectives that have really been overlooked or marginalized. So in some ways, it's sort of recovering perspectives, which in many cases were held by huge amounts of people, but were somehow forgotten or silenced or ignored. So I think it's important to account for this,
Yeah. And in my view, I mean, having managed as well a master in women's studies for the past 6 years in Ireland, I could really see that there was a huge demand for, and a huge interest for feminism and gender studies coming from all over the world, right? So last year we had students from India, China, Palestine. I mean, there's really a strong demand from young women for, to be able to express their activism on gender issues and as feminists. And I think that's also something that's related to the post-Yugoslav space. We saw during this doctoral workshop, which I'm really happy it was really inclusive, right? It was not the usual Serbia-Croatia participants, but it was really inclusive of women, young women also from Kosovo, Albania, Macedonia. I think that really showed really a broad span of interest in gender studies and in feminism. And I think it's important for students, for activists to be able to build their own genealogy and to be able to have their tools to reflect on their own experiences as feminists and as activists in women's NGOs that are fighting against gender violence, poverty, all these issues that are still pressing in the region, right? So also like to keep a link between academia and activism and not just look at, this women's activism in an historical way, but also to try to connect it with current organization and NGOs that are working on these topics.
I think also for students of, I say this as someone who's working for this master program, area studies based, Southeastern European studies. I think it's really important that these students also take classes in gender history of the region. This is sort of included in the kind of, the basic knowledge that students in the masters would gain, that this is part of it. So it doesn't mean that not every person who takes a course in gender history in Southeastern Europe will focus on this for their master thesis or make it kind of their key focus. But it is important that they're aware of it, and it's part of the, let's say, it's the mainstreaming of their knowledge that they're able to handle some of these discussions about gender in the region as well.
What can non-academics learn from your research?
So I think, to look at the ways in which everyday life and sort of micro histories of certain locations and certain places are actually part of the bigger history, right? So not to think of history in simplified views of gender or power, but to think of the ways in which gender is a fluid categories and gender relations are also always changing, right? John Scott, in her famous article about gender as a category of historical analysis, she really made clear that it's important to think gender relations in a way that's, accounting for historical change and not to think of it in a fixed way. So I think to give a broad span and of the complexity of how gender in intersections with other factors is playing out. I think that's important also for somebody who's not academic, but who might have an interest in a certain location because of, origins in the former Yugoslav region, maybe living in Austria, or, I think also to feel an attachment in relation to their own family history, for instance. I did an exercise when I was, teaching women's studies. We always did this exercise of choosing your own foremother in your family or a woman that inspired you in society and to think about her and what's the difference between her position and your own position. So I think that's something that even in non-academic terms can be of interest, how gender relations have changed over time, how geopolitics is changing all the time. Like all of these are topics that can be of interest for non-academics as well.
And of course, in recent years, many non-academics are concerned with gender for different reasons, sometimes very problematically. Some gender has become politicized and in Southeastern Europe as well. So there are, of course, anti-gender movements, kind of some, let's say, moral panics on the right wing of the political spectrum, worrying about so-called gender ideology and so on. So it's important to, as academics, to be able to have an awareness of what's going on, I think, in broader public discourse, and to be able to weigh in, I suppose, as an expert in a way, and to be able to speak, to converse about these about issues to do with gender as well in a broader space.
Defend gender studies, the possibility for gender studies to exist, if you think of places like Hungary where gender studies is practically banned, right? It's still, as Rory said, very important to keep this space and not to reduce gender to this anti-gender ideology that we're hearing about.
Gender und mehr. You also offer a course here at the University of Graz called Women's and Gender History in 20th Century Southeastern Europe. Who can take this course?
Actually, any students can. I think many students can take it as an elective, and we have the course is designed for students who are interested in Southeastern Europe, but we also have students who are taking the course because they're interested in gender, and then through that they're learning about Southeastern Europe and vice versa, where students with a background in Southeastern European studies and maybe haven't taken gender courses before taking that. So it's an interesting dynamic then in the classroom that you have both people who are focused on gender studies and others who are focused on Southeastern Europe and the kind of the dialogues then that occur.
So to any student in Graz who is interested in the seminar by Rory Archer and Chiara Bonfiglioli, look at UniGraz online for more information. And for all other listeners who are interested in the topics we touched in this episode, please check out the show notes. The next episode will be out on the first Tuesday in March and will deal with reproductive justice and queer and trans reproduction in Europe. If you're interested in this topic, there is a conference taking place on the 22nd and 23rd of February. You will find a link with more information on that in the show notes. Thank you very much for listening. Danke fürs Einschalten. Wir hören uns.